Good evening. My name is Nettie. If you haven't met me before, we've all met each other all the time, but conventionally, if you haven't met me before, I'm Nettie. Being in community, having the teachings, doing zazen, being receptive, these are the ways that we deepen our practice. And I am very grateful to be part of this community and to be able to deepen my practice. And I think we are all deepening our practice, which is a good reason to forgive each other and to be open all the time to fresh, new experiences with each other and with the world. In our Monday morning study group, we read the line, "An eye does not see the eye." And then I had the thought that a mirror doesn't pause before it reflects. And a dewdrop doesn't resist the moon. And the moon doesn't ignore the dewdrop. I want my practice to be like that, to be like the eye or the ear, to be like a mirror, like a dewdrop, like the moon. And practice like that, there's no gap, there's no self-consciousness, there's no thought of oneself, there is just pure engagement with whatever is arising. So I thought a name for this talk could be the creativity of limits, because I want to talk about one particular way in which we might help encourage ourselves to be more like an eye or a mirror or a dewdrop or the moon. And for many years I've practiced with sort of creative ways of creating limits to see what will happen. And we have the precepts, and at first glance I think the precepts might not look terribly creative. They sound familiar to the Ten Commandments in a way. They're familiar, kind of, do not kill, do not lie, do not steal. And at first reading, I think they can land not very creatively on the ear. They sound like, okay, I guess so, I should try to do that. But when we slow down and really pay attention, there's just so much room for creativity with the precepts. So I thought I would share some things that I've done over the years before I even knew about the precepts, but maybe I intuited them somehow. When I left school at the age of 16 and went to a technical college and studied art, and we had one subject, one teacher that gave us a task to do just images of bell peppers. In Australia they're called capsicums, but bell peppers, sliced in half. And you were looking at it at the interior. So sitting upright, you could see the outer shape, the sort of concave interior with all the strange, you know, unusual little ridges that are there. There's the main ridges, and then there's very subtle little ones. And then the centerpiece that is usually white with little white seeds. And sometimes they sort of stick to the parts of the bell pepper. So we did, I don't know how many weeks it was for, we only did images of bell peppers. Sometimes it was with just one black line, we didn't lift the pen. Another time it was just shading, no hard lines, just shading. Another time it might have been hyper-realistic sort of an image. But the ones that stayed in my mind was we were asked to do paintings of bell peppers using complementary contrasts. So the complementary contrasts are one primary color matched with the other two primary colors mixed together. So it's purple and yellow, red and green, blue and orange. They're the three pairs of complementary contrasts. And then we were further instructed, and these are like a little mini precept, we were further instructed, you can add white to one of those two. So one image that I did was using blue with various amounts of white added to it to give it different shades, and orange with slight different amounts of yellow and red to give it darker or lighter kind of quality, but rich colours, whereas the blue had white added to it, so it was softer. And that image of the bell pepper done in that, with that limit, with that constraint, created this very beautiful, this incredibly beautiful image. It like jumped off the page. It just jumped. And it stayed with me all my life, to the point that this mala that I wear is influenced by the pale turquoise from that exercise and my watch. I don't wear colour these days, but that's one colour that I do wear a little bit of, and it comes from that experience, from that exercise. I never forgot that exercise. And that image would never have been created had limits not been set, and had those limits not been embraced lovingly. You know, I didn't paint the picture going, oh, if only I could use some green, or oh, I need some black. There wasn't any of that. And if anyone looked at that image, they also wouldn't have had a thought like that. They wouldn't have had a thought of what's missing in the image. They would have just appreciated the image. So this is a way in which we can approach the precepts, and the way in which we can just approach our lives. Can we create our own internally driven limits, not externally? Like in that example, the teacher did offer us that, but I accepted it as my own. I wasn't doing it because I was told to. I mean, on one level I was, but once I was working, it had nothing to do with the teacher. It had nothing to do with any external force telling me what I should or shouldn't do. It wasn't a super ego telling me, it wasn't society telling me. It was me fully embracing that limit and then working with it joyfully. Another exercise, no, I wouldn't call it an exercise, another art piece, another performance that I did was for 100 days, I think, I could be wrong, but 100 sounds good. So let's say it was 100 days. I decided to immerse my body in water that couldn't be a bathtub. So each day I had to find some body of water and make sure that I immersed myself in it. At the time I lived by a river, so that did make it a lot easier. I could just go in the river. But that wasn't necessarily always easy. I remember one night after a long day working on the land, children are in bed, dinner's been had, just about to go to bed, and uh-oh, I haven't done it yet. You know, so having to take the flashlight, tiptoe through the dew, down to the river in the pitch dark, go in the cold water, and come out. There were other times when I was in a city and there wasn't an easy river to be found, so I had to kind of take the time to look around, find a park that maybe had a pond. Even look at the landscape and think, where might there be some sort of creek, you know, and find something. And it was an internally driven limit. This limit didn't come from anybody else, and absolutely nobody even knew I was doing this. This is the first time I've ever talked about it. It was just something that I did for myself. And I wasn't a Buddhist practitioner then, I don't think, but I was deepening just my appreciation of life And in that process, I was forgetting myself. I was paying attention to bodies of water and paying attention in a non-habitual way, like in a city. To look around for bodies of water is sort of something you generally are not doing. You're more likely to be thinking about traffic lights and which direction and numbers on buildings and that sort of thing, where to park the car. In this case, I was paying attention to where could I find bodies of water, just at some point during my day. I remember one time, the only body of water I could find was sort of like a muddy ditch at the side of a dirt road. Must have been on the outskirts somewhere. Maybe it wasn't in the city. Maybe I was somewhere else. And just like having to roll around in that. That was the best I could do. And it created all sorts of appreciations in my mind about all sorts of things. Like all sorts of things went through my mind about how important water is, how some people have access and some people don't, how some people can shower and some people can't. All kinds of things, you know, opportunities to forget myself and unite with this big, beautiful world. Another project that I did after I had become involved with Zen practice, it was going to go for 365 days, but my camera broke on the 300th day, which I was very glad it was the 300th, because that was just a nice number. For 300 days, I took just one image, and it was a camera with film in it, so you didn't get to see the image until after it was developed. So it would be like a month's lag before I saw any of the images. And just one frame, no flash, and I could adjust the aperture, but that's all. It was a fairly simple single reflex lens camera, not a complicated camera, a beautiful camera, and quite a heavy one. So I had to carry that camera around with me wherever I was going and whatever I was doing, so I would make sure that I would take that photograph. And there was three images. The first day would be an object. The second day would be a shadow. And the third day, a reflection. And then it will just go again, object, shadow, reflection, object, shadow, reflection. And similarly with the water project, there were times where I would forget. And then at night I would have to find a way to take a photograph without using a flash, but that would be, you know, I was wanting to make beautiful images that respect objects, shadows and reflections. It wasn't any old object, shadow or reflection, although everything is beautiful. But I was endeavouring to make beautiful images. And so since then I've had a thought about why did I choose those three, or what meaning can I make now thinking about those three? Object, shadow, reflection. And some time ago I came across the three natures. The imaginary nature, which might surprisingly not think to align with objects, but the imaginary nature aligns with objects because objects as separate entities is in our imagination. This is not actually so. It's our imagination that it's like that. It's the way our cognition works that we perceive it that way. So it's an imaginary nature, but still a nature worth celebrating, still a nature worth photographing and worth being joyful about and to lose myself in. I remember one time just seeing a faucet at a park, like a state park, and it had rusted, it was by the sea, and so it had lots of corrosion, and just all sorts of colours had emerged from the corroded metal, with the salt drying on it, and maybe some of the different minerals in the water. I remember loving photographing that faucet, which we would call a tap in Australia. And then the shadow could fit with the second nature, which is the interdependent nature. And that's because a shadow requires an object, a surface, and a light source. So at the very minimum, it needs three things. And of course, if you have one thing, you have everything. If you have three things, you absolutely for sure have everything involved. So the shadow is like the interdependent nature. And then the reflection is our true nature, the true nature of things, where there is absolutely no gap, like the mirror that doesn't hesitate when it reflects. It doesn't reject anything that, the surface of the water doesn't reject anything that comes past it. And one of the ones I remember from that set was of an old plastic trash can, the round ones, so that when you turn them upside down, they have sort of rings, and it's sort of concave and convex like that. So there's sort of indents, and it had rained, and so the circles were filled with water. And there was big eucalyptus trees hanging over it. And so when I photographed it, I set the aperture so that the reflected eucalyptus leaves were in focus and the trash can itself was completely out of focus. And the result was just sort of three circles of eucalyptus leaves. It was really quite an amazing image that I had no idea whether it would work, because of course I didn't get to see it until a month later. But it did. So the project I'm, the performance piece or the living art project that I'm doing at the moment is inspired by a peach tree that called out the Dharma to me on Ocean Street. On Ocean Street between Water and SoCal, just near where my office is, there's a Jack in the Box fast food place, which you might, some of you might recall. And next to that is an Avis rental car place. And then next to that is a tattoo parlor. So that little patch there is, it's not very aesthetically pleasing spot. But in the parking lot of the Avis rental car place is a peach tree. And it was fully laden with peaches. And that's what caught my eye. As I was riding by on my bike, I just saw this, you know, all this bright orange coming from the peach tree. So I went and asked the man at the Avis rental car place if I could pick some, and he just said, take them all. He did not have an interest in them. So I picked them all, but over a couple of weeks to allow other people to pick them. But as far as I'm aware, nobody else did. Which I thought was also interesting, that there was a jack-in-the-box, low-cost, cheap food just next door, but nobody picked the peaches. So having the abundance of those peaches got me thinking, I wonder if I could try just eating fruit and vegetables and see how long I can go without eating anything else. So I started that for a little while because I have a vegetable garden, but it didn't take me too long to realize that that probably wasn't quite going to be sustainable, because I was going to run out of peaches. Wasn't necessarily going to get another whole bunch. And so I modified my plan, my art project, to eating only what I grow, what I gather, or what I'm given. And I always like to kind of like three G's, gather, grown, given, just sounds nice. And so I think I'm in my seventh week of doing that. There's a few tiny exceptions, like olive oil for cooking, rooibos tea with soy milk in the morning. So a couple of little exceptions. But other than those little exceptions, just what I grow, gather, or am given. And it has been an incredibly beautiful and unexpected experience. I find myself just looking at potatoes with just like, my God, they're so amazing. I love them. Because I've just spaced them out to last the week to get that heavy carbohydrate. And I get a bag of groceries from Grey Bears, which also begins with a G, which is rather nice. And that's a bag of fruit and vegetables and a loaf of bread. So that loaf of bread is feeling very precious. And one of the nice things about grey bears is it is all food that would otherwise, that the grocery store no longer wants, that they feel is not suitable for the shelves anymore. So it would otherwise, you know, go into a dumpster. So it's wonderful that there is this great service that is good for people and good for the planet. And feels lovely to have this project, this self-designed limit, this self-designed precept, being good for the planet. You know, I think you could do them in any way. They don't have to be directly good for the planet. But I think anything that we do that helps us lose ourself and connects us with the world is good for the planet. Because the planet is us. We are it. And when we're feeling unified like that, that's good. That's good for the planet. So my appreciation of food has increased enormously. And again, like with the project about water, it's left me thinking about how other people relate to food. It's broken my conventional, habitual way of thinking about food, because I can't just go and get what I want. I'm eating what I have and what arrives and being very grateful for whatever arrives. So I think of other people in other countries or other situations and how they relate to food. So it's deepening my sense of intimacy with them. And the small number of people that have known that I've been doing this have been giving me food, which has been a beautifully humbling experience to have food on my doorstep or sitting on the washing machine or on my kitchen bench or just handed to me. Lot of gratitude when that happens. You know, and that's creating, it's a, when one of us does a creative, beautiful thing, it generates creative, beautiful things in others. You know? It just ripples out. So anything you do for yourself will, that is good for you, will be good for everybody else. So I had a thought of just a tiny little project that we could do together, just a very, very tiny one, which would be for each of us to look anywhere in the Zendo. The altar is probably a good choice, but the ceiling could be good too, or the floor, or underneath the tans, and just pay attention to either vertical lines, horizontal lines, or curved lines. So let's just try that for, you know, maybe 1 minute. Just pay attention. Pick one of those three and just give your attention to that. Okay. Would anyone like to share just what that felt like? Anything you noticed about yourself or your experience or the objects when you did that? Kokyo?
Looking straight ahead without moving my eyes at all, I see this vertical and horizontal sitting platform with this beautiful microphone cord curving and weaving through it. And I was kind of already looking at it, but I really didn't notice it until you engaged us in this project. And I thought, this is like a beautiful art.
Yes.
You see the way the cord, the curving cord, weaves through these perpendiculars. When you mentioned it, I thought, actually this Zendo is almost all horizontal and perpendicular lines. And I heard a kind of energy worker person once came in here years ago and said, there's too many horizontals and verticals, the space needs to be broken up. Well, it's kind of a Zen thing. It's right angles, but this microphone cord just does the trick completely. Thanks for pointing it out.
And my guess is that as you were appreciating the cord, you completely were forgetting yourself. And I think that is the most, the way in which our practice deepens the most. When we do that and we forget ourselves, we are the same as an eye that does not see the eye. We have closed that gap. We are just in total accord with what is happening. Would anyone else like to share what happened for them, Stan?
Looking at the beautiful, I'm guessing, redwood door behind you, and the lines going up and down that are way long and not quite straight, but they're pretty straight on, and then thinking that those were each a year of growth for that tree. And that's many years of growth at them.
And isn't that beautiful that we spontaneously start to think about the much bigger picture?
Yeah.
Like you began to think about trees and trees growing, mm-hmm. which probably might have brought in forests and mm-hmm. and time. And we just do that. I think our nature is to be fully connected and in accord with all things. That is actually our nature. We just have a bit of a habit of forgetting. Mm-hmm. We get a little hypnotized by the thoughts rotating in our mind, that are looping over in our mind. We just accidentally do that. And these are ways, if we can think of our life as art, if we can think of it that way, because when you go to an art gallery, you look at a painting and you give it your full attention. I think it's one of the reasons people enjoy art galleries, is not just the art, but they lose themselves at that time. So we can think of our whole life as a work of art. Mm-hmm. And we can create little projects like this mm-hmm. many, many times a day. Mm-hmm. And we don't. We just do it. We can just do it. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Stan.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to share anything, Kathy?
Yeah, I was looking at the top horizontal of the wood that goes all the way around. And I was having the experience of deep intimacy. I do know how this place was built, because I was here then. So it makes me think of Catherine, because she was one of the people who made the micro decisions about how this remodel would actually look, and her energy and her preferences and her mind and her body and heart are in the decisions and the choices that she spearheaded for the reconstruction of the Zendo. Mm-hmm. And the wood, the dark wood, some of you may know this, but maybe others don't, was actually from the old Zendo. Mm-hmm. So the building that was taken down because it was falling apart is also still alive in this one. Mm-hmm. And back when they built that building, like a couple hundred years ago or whatever, they used old growth redwood. So this is old growth redwood. Mm-hmm. So the redwood, the forest, is here, the ancient ones, the ancestors, which we thankfully don't cut down anymore, but they're here because of all the things we did. So there's a lot of that feeling of intimacy I was just in touch with as I was letting my eyes go around and just letting all that soak in.
Thank you. So you can create projects like this. Quite often when I'm either riding my bike or driving to my office, it's only a very short distance, I'll just make a choice, like I said earlier, an internally set limit. Nobody else is doing it. I'm choosing. It's my precept. I'm choosing it. I'll do something like decide, rather than having my eyes land on all the habitual things that I normally look at, there's certain things, all of us do this when we drive, I imagine we all do this. We have certain sides of the road we tend to look at, certain buildings we tend to pay attention to. We just have our habits. So, again, there's another way of sort of loosening those habits so that more of the world can be invited in. I do things like decide, I'm just going to see if I can look at negative spaces. So rather than looking at trees, I look at the shape between the trees and the sky, the shape. Or I might decide to pay attention to the birds and the paths that they're flying. Of course, without, you know, failing to pay attention to the road. Sometimes it may be looking at the infrastructure, power lines, the water, those things that come up for the plumbing, that maybe they're gas, things like that, piping going along the side of buildings. You can just pick things and then notice to what extent can you continue to do that and how quickly do you get distracted and start thinking about what you're going to do when you get to where you're going. That's also just interesting to notice actually how difficult it is to decide on something and then do it. Even for 1 minute, it can be quite hard to maintain it for even 1 minute. So that in itself is an interesting experience. So you can just make these things up. You know, you can do things like decide, for 1 week, I'm going to have a different type of breakfast to what I usually have. And that will get you in touch just with maybe how other cultures do things, or just for you to taste different foods and appreciate it because you're used to having toast or you're used to having oatmeal, or, you know. So there's, all of these things ultimately are good for the earth. They're not just arbitrary fun games. They are serving a very important purpose of deepening our sense of connection and intimacy with all things and realizing that we are all these things. This is who we are these things. So, would anyone like to comment or ask questions about anything related to this?
Yes. I most readily experience this when I'm digging in the earth or my composting worms. I completely lose myself, and then the composting worm box, they all become entities, and they're meshed, and there's 100 of them, and a half an avocado. And it just makes me look at that as an entire world, just in that compass, and it's so huge to me.
You could say in that moment, that's enlightened practice right there.
Oh, yes.
Just like Dogen says when we do zazen, that is enlightened practice while we do zazen. So while you tend to the worms. Kathy?
I think what I'm most struck by in what you're sharing is the invitation to consider our sense of agency with regards to our mental faculties. That, you know, we tend to just fall into habit patterns mm-hmm. with what we do with our minds. Mm-hmm. And you're suggesting just a real realm of creative possibility. Mm. That we can actually have some intentionality with how we use that resource.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. That's exactly right. That's, as you say it, I realize that is exactly what I was wanting to say, that we have infinite agency here to awaken through these practices. There's just no limit. And it's all there for us. And all of us are creative beings. We can come up with things. All of us can, yes. So thank you.
As most of you know, my wife and I sub over the district, and I go around and pick up food that would be thrown out. The students leave, and there's a whole bag full stretched out. There's apples and carrots and all that, and all kinds of things outside for you. Please help yourself and take when you leave.
And it's beautiful that you do that, Stan. And that can be, you can view that as a work of art. And the reason I think of that as a work of art is like a sculpture. When you lay those things there, you can think of it as a sculpture. And the reason to use language like that is it helps us respect it and pay attention to it. It helps us do that. Yeah, and it's good for the earth.
Yep.
But using this sort of language, I think, can help us actually appreciate. We, the way we put our feet in our shoes, we can think of that as ballet. Oh, putting my feet in.
Yeah.
How I step down the three steps at the front of your house. That can be tap dancing. Just helps us to really be attentive and celebrate. Celebrate and be attentive. So limits, it's very important with precepts and limits that they're celebratory. Otherwise, I think if they're not, it means that we're actually feeling pressured from some imaginary external source telling us. And that is not what, there is no external source. Yes.
Just the terms that come to mind are intimacy, engagement, grace. And so if I thought to myself, I want to playfully and creatively, instead of like sleepwalking, go through this hour of my day, or one thing I love to sometimes do is to think every gesture I do, I want to feel a gracefulness in. So that feels like I'm sort of dancing through my life. But also, in that, anytime I think that we can do something, any choice like that, like you say, with the engagement, it helps that that oneness with things, you know, does make a big difference in the world.
Yeah.
And starts a movement of some kind. It's a seed of something.
Thank you. Just before finishing, I think I'd like to say a couple of words about difficulty, because we've spoken so far in really kind of like joyful terms, and I just want to say a few words about how we can still find beauty in difficulty. So there's a painting by Goya called The 3rd of May, 1808, and it's an image of an execution occurring in Spain. People love that painting. They don't love that painting because of the subject matter in terms of the unpleasantness of the subject matter. But if you look at the painting closely, and in fact, the way I found this is I just Googled famous paintings of executions, and there it popped up. So you can go look at this painting if you want by Goya. What is beautiful about this painting is the man, his arms are outstretched and he's looking at the group of men with their rifles, and you can see how much he loves his life. He loves life. And there's something beautiful seeing he loves life. We all love life. Everything loves life. So we don't want to tread on little insects. They love their life. They're trying to get home to their parents. We don't want to tread on them. And the people who, and he's looking at them because he knows that they also love their lives. So there's pleading in his eyes because he knows they are actually the same as him. And he is the same as them. They, at that moment, may not be fully aware of the case, but he does know it in that moment, and that's why he's looking at them. He wouldn't stare at them that way if it was a machine. There'd be no point in staring at the machine, but that he's looking at them because he knows they are the same as him. And they are dressed head to toe in military garb as if to keep their true nature locked in so it can't get out. They have to do that so that they can do their job. So even in them we can see that they truly are loving beings trapped in their circumstance. We all get trapped in circumstances. And there's six of them, or eight of them, because none of them want to actually be responsible. And that shows their true nature as well. They don't want to be the ones. So that painting, even though it is difficult subject matter, has an infinite amount of beauty in it when we look at it closely. And so when difficult things happen in our lives, we can think of them as a painting and look carefully and see where is the wisdom in this event that is happening in my life. So I just wanted to make sure to include that at the end. Okay. Thank you so much. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them.
Delusions are inexhaustible.